Welcome to Computing Lives, an author's podcast from the IEEE Annals of the History of Computing. The Annals documents the stories of the information age. It publishes stories of technological innovation, stories of commerce, stories of computing institutions, and stories of computing people. This podcast deals with the issue of software as a product. Once upon a time, software was not something that you sold or leased. It came with a computer in the concept known as bundling. This edition of Computing Lives looks at that concept through the eyes of two different people. First, historian Emerson Pugh tells us that the idea of bundling originated with Herman Hollerith in the punched card machine. Next, businessman Bert Grad explains how IBM dropped the idea of bundling for the concept of software as a product. The Origins of Software Bundling by Emerson Pugh. When did software bundling begin, and who originated it? This practice, making a single-priced offering of a combination of software and hardware, is often attributed to Thomas J. Watson, Jr. It was he, after all, who led IBM into the electronics era soon after the end of World War II, and presided over the development, manufacture, and marketing of the company's first electronic computers. Beginning with this premise, industry observers are likely to cite the bundling by IBM systems and applications programs, including the IBM-developed Fortran compilers, as evidence of the company's nefarious methods of locking customers into IBM hardware. Also offensive to some observers was the company's sponsorship of two associations for the users of IBM computers, Share and Guide, that made it possible for users to share programs and to communicate with one another and with IBM about current applications and future product requirements. These activities, combined with the practice of renting rather than selling equipment and providing hardware maintenance and customer education as part of that rental agreement, gave IBM continual information about the needs of its customers and tended to lock customers into IBM as their sole supplier. More sophisticated industry observers know, however, that most of these practices date back to the punched card era, which was presided over by Tom Watson's father, Thomas J. Watson, Sr., from 1914 until shortly before his death in 1956. These observers note that Watson, Sr. rented and refused to sell punched card equipment and included hardware maintenance and applications methods know-how, the functional predecessor of software, at no extra charge. In 1931, the company established a methods research department at corporate headquarters to formalize the acquisition and centralization of data processing methods know-how so that these methods could be made available more effectively to all customers. As one member of that department observed during the Depression years, only through technical tricks was it possible to hold a customer's rental at a minimum figure and yet accomplish the required tasks. The new department soon began publishing a news bulletin called Pointers, which offered ingenious plugboard wiring arrangements for customers. A key feature of IBM punch card equipment was the use of electrical sensing of holes in the cards. This method contrasted with the use of mechanical detection by IBM's primary competitor, Remington Rand. Even minor modifications to the previously defined tasks required the mechanical connection box to be returned to Remington Rand for modification, whereas the plugboard wiring of IBM equipment could be modified on-site, even by the customer. The possibility for customers to reprogram equipment on-site and to achieve minor modifications or major innovations was only one reason why education for customers soon became an important part of IBM service. Although Watson Sr. and Watson Jr. played important roles in promoting these business practices, credit for their creation belongs primarily to an often overlooked pioneer of information processing, Herman Hollerith. Born in Buffalo, New York in 1860, Hollerith became interested in the possibility of automating the process of tabulating the U.S. Census when, as a young engineer, he was hired to help analyze the 1880 census. While working at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and then later at the U.S. Patent Office in Washington, D.C., Hollerith persistently pursued his goal of devising a method to tabulate the census automatically. By 1889, he had invented, constructed, and demonstrated his punch card equipment with sufficient success to win a contract to tabulate the U.S. Census of 1890. Hollerith hired the Pratt & Whitney and Western Electric Companies to manufacture his equipment. He set a monthly rental of $1,000 each for the first 50 systems delivered to the U.S. Census Bureau. According to the terms of the contract, Hollerith was responsible for supplying the equipment, devising the methods for using it, and for its successful operation. Only through full-time efforts by himself and an assistant was he able to keep all the equipment operating every day and thus avoid forfeiting the $10 per day for each malfunctioning system that was specified in the contract. Hollerith expanded his business to tabulate the census of other countries and then to handling payroll, billing, inventory, and other business functions for railroads and insurance companies. As he did so, he continued his policies of renting rather than selling equipment and of including operational methods and equipment maintenance as part of the rental agreement. In describing his business philosophy to Tom Watson Sr., soon after the latter was hired as general manager in 1914, Hollerith said, "It's a good deal better never to have the machines put in than to have them fail." Thus it is that Herman Hollerith, the inventor, the engineer, and the entrepreneur who started the information processing industry, also started many of IBM's business practices that were viewed unfavorably in latter years. For him, however, it was a matter of necessity. Customers did not know how to use the punch card equipment to solve their business problems, and they certainly did not want to be responsible for maintaining the equipment. In responding to customer needs, Hollerith was led almost inevitably to his policies of providing full service and support rather than just selling or renting equipment. By continuing many of Hollerith's policies, and through his own exceptional skills as a business leader, Thomas Watson Sr. maintained the company, which he had renamed IBM in 1924, as the dominant worldwide supplier of punch card equipment. As the government asserted in its antitrust lawsuit of 1952, IBM now owns all electrical tabulation machines in use in the United States, which comprise 90% of all tabulation machines now in use in this country. The settlement of that case in 1956 required Watson Jr. to sell, as well as rent, both tabulating punch card equipment and electronic computers, and to allow and even help others to service IBM equipment. But the settlement did not require him to charge separately for software. The threat of another government antitrust suit filed against IBM in January 1969 contributed to the company's decision to unbundle some of its software in June of that year. The antitrust suit droned on for another 13 years before the government finally dropped the case, asserting that it had been without merit. Meanwhile, the already competitive market for computer systems, components, software, and support services became more turbulent. By the 1990s, concerns over hardware and software bundling had largely vanished, only to be replaced by concerns over the bundling of various software programs into a single offering, as epitomized by Microsoft's practices relative to its application programs and its popular Windows operating system. With multiple suppliers for virtually everything in an information processing system, many of us look back nostalgically to the world of Hollerith and the two Watsons. In a time when hardware, software, and services were bundled, it was necessary to contact only one supplier to get rapid solutions for all problems. A Personal Recollection, IBM's Unbundling of Software and Services by Bert Grad. The System 360 hardware and system software had, by 1968, propelled IBM to mainframe market dominance. The wealth of available systems and application software for the System's 360 was a major reason why so many companies decided to acquire these mainframe systems, beside the feeling that no one ever got fired for buying an IBM system. With the System 360, IBM had created a de facto system standard. To compete, other hardware vendors could choose to make their machines more like IBM's, that is, plug-compatible or operating systems program-compatible, or they could devote themselves to market niches with smaller market shares. Neither option satisfied the other major computer hardware companies, Burroughs, UNIVAC, NCR, Control Data, Honeywell, RCA, and General Electric. With Control Data Corporation in the lead during the 1967-68, the competitors urged the U.S. Department of Justice to file an antitrust suit against IBM. Their complaint stated that IBM had achieved and maintained its dominant market position not because of better products, good marketing, solid sales practices, or quality support, but principally through IBM's willingness to provide whatever level of support and services the client wanted without charging directly for these services. The suit claimed that these were, in effect, bundled sales and that IBM did not give the same value by, for example, charging the same price for the same amount of work to each customer. The competitors claimed that IBM selectively used these extra services and programs to win new business and persuade current customers not to switch to other vendors. They charged that IBM maintained its monopolistic power by these anti-competitive practices. The competitors also argued that IBM business practices made it very difficult for other companies to interface their products with IBM equipment and system software. Finally, they charged that IBM selectively lowered prices and pre-announced new systems in order to inhibit or even to eliminate competition. IBM had introduced the System 360 in 1964 on the same terms previously offered for its other computers and for its punch card equipment. Like all computer manufacturers, IBM leased computers to customers on a full-service monthly rental basis. Similarly, IBM provided training, maintenance, and some level of systems engineering service to enable its customers to use the computers effectively. IBM felt these business practices were responsive to the marketplace and to customer needs. It believed this bundled structure helped smaller customers affordably get the additional help they needed while permitting larger customers to develop their own specialized applications. Nevertheless, some people in the data processing division felt that IBM was missing out on a lucrative opportunity to separately package and price application software. Accordingly, the company sponsored two studies, one in 1967 and another in early 1968, to explore what the data processing division might accomplish by producing applications programs of value to specific industries. These studies were aimed at determining what prices could be charged for these programs, how many copies might be sold, and what it would cost to build and maintain these software products. I was assigned to work on both of these studies, the results of which were ambiguous. They showed a strong level of customer interest for large transaction processing, database-oriented programs in virtually every industry. What was not clear was how much customers would pay for a packaged, not customized, program, and whether, given the high costs of development and IBM's method for allocating overhead, these could be sufficiently profitable offerings. We were unable to convince either the data processing division or IBM Corporation that this direction was worthwhile. During 1968, IBM was well aware that the Department of Justice was pursuing the possibility of a suit against it, alleging monopoly in the computer market. IBM assessed its position during the fall of 1968 and concluded that it probably could not successfully defend itself against an antitrust charge stemming from tie-in sales because of its bundling practices. IBM executives were especially concerned about the systems engineering services provided at different levels to different customers, because the amount of these services was not directly related to the price customers paid for the hardware. Systems engineering was, in fact, viewed by IBM as the core of the tie-in sales problem. systems and application programs, and other services such as education and field maintenance, were not viewed as critical in their own right. IBM's concerns about bundling existed because of its large market share, although the computer industry's other major manufacturers were all bundling their services too. Meanwhile, because the Department of Justice did not act quickly to file suit against IBM, Control Data Corporation initiated its own suit against IBM in December 1968, charging that various IBM practices were monopolistic and had damaged Control Data's growth and earnings. This suit targeted IBM's practices related to early announcements of new product lines competing with Control Data's advancing hardware products. Additionally, the suit cited IBM's having directly provided service bureau functions through a back door, a remote online service operation in the data processing division, though not the Service Bureau Corporation, which had been maintained by the 1956 consent decree to provide all IBM service bureau activities. IBM executives had held discussions with senior Department of Justice attorneys and believed that IBM could preempt a Department of Justice suit by announcing that it would unbundle its services, then doing so promptly. This seemed far better than waiting for a Department of Justice suit and negotiating a new consent decree, or dealing with a long, expensive trial. The financial threat to IBM was enormous. If the U.S. government could prove that IBM had improperly obtained and exercised monopoly power in the computer field and had thereby harmed its competitors, every affected competitor and many customers could claim treble damages. Competitors could claim lost sales revenue and profits. Customers could argue that they had paid excessive fees but not received full value from the bundled price. This possibility would have threatened IBM's business existence. IBM also believed that preemptive action might be a defense against later suits if IBM could show that it had taken reasonable corrective steps as soon as the problem's nature was evident and the market and technology had matured sufficiently. Management hoped that these actions might mitigate or eliminate damage judgments for previous actions and prevent claims for additional future damages. Therefore, on the 6th of December 1968, IBM announced that it would unbundle the major services previously included free with its hardware offerings and would announce specific changes by the 1st of July 1969. IBM also pledged to implement the changes in a timely fashion, but it would honor and satisfy existing commitments to its customers. Unfortunately for IBM's preemptive strategy, on the last days of the Johnson administration, the 17th of January 1969, U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark filed an antitrust suit against IBM. By this time, IBM was already committed to unbundling, and it still believed that the changes were necessary to defend itself against private suits as well as the Department of Justice suit. To carry out this strategic directive and to plan and establish the basis for separately pricing various services and software offerings, IBM created the Unbundling Task Force. A team of almost 100 people was initially assembled in mid-December 1968, each member on full-time assignment. The task force, located in the Van Cohorn building in White Plains, was instructed to operate independently and avoid contact with people in the company's operating divisions, except to collect information from them. The task force was divided into five teams, each addressing a service or support area that might be unbundled: systems engineering, education, field engineering, custom programming, and packaged software. The task force members represented IBM's hardware, marketing, pricing, finance, and legal departments, among others. I was assigned to represent the data processing division on the packaged software team. The key software-related issues addressed by the team included 1. Separation between systems programming and application programming. 2. How to handle programming languages, sorts, and utility programs. 3. How to determine which programs would be separately priced. 4. How to handle the programs already available versus those in the process of being developed and those that would be developed in the future. And finally, how to handle possible problems that could be caused by charging for systems engineering while still providing some software products for free. These complexities stemmed from IBM's long business history and recent operating precedents. For many years, IBM had developed and distributed programs to customers that performed a variety of tasks on small, medium, and large computers. Programs ranged from the primary operating systems, systems utilities, and programming language compilers, to a range of commercial and scientific applications. In some cases, these programs had been developed in conjunction with specific customers who were willing to have IBM let other companies share them. In other cases, programs had been built by IBM systems engineers, both in the U.S. and internationally. Furthermore, many programs had been developed on a professional basis in the product division for systems programming and the marketing divisions for significant business and scientific application programs. Initially, most of IBM's applications programs were viewed as illustrative models that would assist customers in designing and building their own programs. But with the advent of the System 360 and the increased use of standard scientific packages like linear programming, project management, and simulation, customers could directly use these programs. They were designed to address many customer needs and were programmed for efficiency, accuracy, and were thoroughly tested. They were packaged and marketed in conjunction with hardware sales, especially for some of the smaller systems. For example, the newspaper composition system was key to the significant sales of the IBM 1130 computer. The Unbundling Task Force examined the investment required to build and maintain major systems programs like the System 360's operating systems. Because these programs were already available to thousands of customers, there seemed no way to charge existing customers sufficient money to recover the original investment, or to support the large programming staffs necessary to maintain and to enhance the products. The conclusion was that IBM could not charge enough to make these public domain operating system products profitable. With regard to applications, the economics and business impacts were not as obvious. It appeared that there might be a reasonable case to charge companies for the use of new application programs, and that IBM could find enough paying customers to make this profitable. Even here, there were problems, because most major programs were being developed in conjunction with customers and had been committed to various accounts to sell them new or additional computer hardware. It was also not clear in advance what the business outlook would be for programming languages, system utilities, and certain hybrid systems application programs like the Customer Information Control System for transaction processing and the Information Management System for database management. Today, companies follow a well-defined set of practices in pricing, licensing, distributing, maintaining, and enhancing software products. But in 1968-69, only a few dozen software products were for sale, and there were no standard terms and conditions. So IBM had to conduct its own comprehensive analysis to establish how to package and price these software products and related software services. We individually examined each program under development, but not yet released, to determine its cost and potential market. Additionally, a comprehensive pricing strategy was worked out, using essentially the same procedures, logic, and rules as used in pricing IBM hardware. This involved analyzing the market opportunity, projecting the unit sales at different price levels, then determining whether the expected revenue would generate sufficient profit after deducting the full development and maintenance costs with their associated overhead and full marketing, sales, and support costs, as well as the general and administrative costs allocations. Simultaneously, the in-house IBM lawyers were drafting contracts to protect IBM's right to these programs, yet permit customers reasonable use. This included consideration of whether the programs would be sold or must be licensed, who had what rights of ownership and use, and whether a program could be run on only a single machine, on multiple machines, at a single site, or at multiple sites in an organization. The task force also analyzed maintenance service obligations, including telephone support, correction of errors, enhancements. Included also the possibility of different classes of service for different classes of programs. We reviewed the issue of who would provide this direct service, systems engineers, field engineers, or headquarters personnel, either at regional or at headquarters-based development centers. To compound our problems, in April 1969, IBM was sued by Applied Data Research in regard to Applied Data Research's Auto Flow program. Applied Data Research claimed that IBM was giving away a somewhat comparable flowcharting program, thereby preventing Applied Data Research from realizing reasonable economic benefits from its AutoFlow investment. Applied Data Research then acquired Programmatics and sued IBM regarding IBM's free sorting program. One possibility that IBM considered was whether an Applied Data Research settlement was desirable to clear the decks, or if it was better to let the suit stay open at least until the unbundling announcement had been made. The concern was how to prevent, or at least not encourage, other similar software suits. By May 1969, after much research, analysis, and debate, the unbundling task force produced its recommendations. Almost all services would have to be separately priced to minimize the risk of future suits and to limit damage. These services might not be particularly profitable businesses by themselves, but the task force felt there was no other choice. IBM still wanted to use these services to help sell hardware, but recognized that the new businesses had to be set up to make money. If they consistently lost money, IBM could possibly be subject to prosecution for selling lost leaders. The recommendation from our package software team were to differentiate between system control programs and all other systems and application programs. Systems control programs included the operating systems and primary systems maintenance facilities, but not the language compilers, the utilities, or any application programs. The systems control programs would still be delivered with the equipment. All other programs would be packaged and marketed on an individually priced basis. We recommended that programs could only be licensed to avoid the issue of purchase and recopy, and that they would be charged on a monthly basis and would include maintenance and support. Only official IBM programs would be announced and supported. No provisions were to be made for handling programs developed by systems engineers or by customers. Systems control software was, in fact, the only area in which IBM decided not to unbundle. Such rationale was that the implementation of certain functions in hardware and software was technologically so intertwined that the decision on how to implement a function should be based on engineering and economic considerations, not on pricing policies. IBM decided it was necessary to draw the line between systems control programs and the price software, and then to hold the line as long as possible. IBM had also determined that most systems engineering work was for marketing and sales support and would not have to be separately priced. However, when later experience showed that much of the previous systems engineering work was of a programming or other technical support nature, systems engineering shifted almost entirely to priced unit activities, for which most customers were unwilling to pay. After executive management's approval of the recommendation, the task force expanded to include hundreds of additional people to implement the new unbundling policies. Their work included developing customer price announcement packages, sales rep compensation plans, and on and on and on. The announcements of the 23rd of June, 1969, were in many ways like simultaneously opening five new plays. After 6 months of isolation and total concentration, each unbundling task force team, systems engineering, education, field engineering, custom programming, and packaged software, had produced an individually priced service or product to supplement and help sell the underlying computer equipment that was still IBM's bread, butter, and jam. After all, the intent of the entire unbundling activity was to limit IBM's exposure to damage suits and to monopoly penalties from previous behavior, and also to have a clean slate going forward, rather than creating major new growth activities. retaining the play analogy, opening night exposed to IBM's new services and products to the entire business world, which, to put it most charitably, did not always give IBM rave reviews. Instead, each new service and product was panned unmercifully by customers, competitors, the financial press, and by the Department of Justice. Possibly more significant, IBM as a whole was criticized as having labored mightily and brought forth a litter of mice, all of whom appeared to be seriously diseased. Nonetheless, IBM's unbundling announcement had a number of significant effects that together encouraged the growth and profitability of independent computer software and services companies. One short-term, unforeseen effect that the long-term implications was to significantly reduce the training customers gave to their new programmers. This resulted both from IBM's pricing of educational services and the 1969 to 1971 recession. The net effect was that by 1972, when the U.S. emerged from the recession, well-trained programmers were in short supply. When companies wanted to program applications quickly, they had to turn to existing professional programming services firms. These firms then were able to establish profitable long-term relationships with major insurance companies, banks, and communications companies, for example. The professional services firms paid well for the experienced and trained COBOL programmers and could hire them away from customer shops, which did not pay top salaries. Larry Schoenberg, one of the founders of the AGS Computers, one of the firms that benefited from this new demand, believes that this helped shape the computer industry during the 1970s. He feels that professional services growth was the first result of the unbundling, and that software product growth was only the secondary beneficiary of that unbundling. Another effect of the education prices set by IBM was to encourage other companies to set up learning institutes aimed at training entry-level programmers. Some institutes were quite professional. Others were incompetent frauds. What's more, a number of professional service companies felt encouraged to produce packaged programs and market them aggressively. This helped lead to the growth of database and data communication systems, the introduction of broad-based time-sharing systems, and the production of cross-industry application programs, accounting and payroll. An interesting sidelight was that because the new, relatively undercapitalized, software products firms could not financially afford to match IBM's practice of renting software, they charged an upfront fee for delivery and installation. The customers were then charged an annual maintenance and upgrade fee for telephone support, error correction, and delivery of some enhancements. Eventually, the success of this practice by the independent software firms persuaded IBM to offer its customers a similar pricing alternative. Customers could then obtain a multi-year license for use of a program product and only pay annually for the maintenance and update charges. Certainly in 1970, very few in the computer industry or in the financial community could envision the opportunity for growth in package software or professional programming services that would occur over the next 30 years. As a consequence of unbundling, IBM unquestionably became the largest supplier of computer software and services during the 1970s and 80s. However, it could never control that business in the same way it had, and has, dominated the mainframe hardware market. While IBM was acting in its own primarily defensive self-interest when it unbundled, that decision became one of the most effective marketing devices IBM could have used to support long-term growth and profitability for itself and for the industry as a whole. Unfortunately for IBM, it was unable to generate high profits from the revenue growth in the computer software and services market. Its once dominant market position eroded from 1970 through 1995. Since 1995, IBM has become a much more significant force in solution services and in major application software products. Its recent stock price has reflected this renewed profit growth. IBM settled the Control Data suit in early 1973, selling the Service Bureau Corporation to Control Data at a discounted price and paying Control Data more than $100 million for various future services and to cover its past legal fees. In turn, IBM obtained all of Control Data's work papers and computerized discovery indices, which it then destroyed, which meant that they couldn't be used by the Department of Justice. While this didn't make the Department of Justice very happy, IBM was apparently legally entitled to do so. As a result, the Department of Justice had to recreate all the files that they needed to pursue the antitrust suit against IBM. IBM also settled the Applied Data Research software suits in August of 1970, but the main issue, charging for IBM programs, had already been resolved through the 1969 unbundling decision. Finally, the Department of Justice suit went to trial in 1975. The trial dragged on without resolution for 7 more years until the 8th of January, 1982, when the Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust, one William F. Baxter, dismissed the suit, citing his opinion that the case was without merit. You've been listening to Computing Lives. This podcast was based on a pair of articles that were published in Volume 24, Number 1 of the IEEE Annals of the History of Computing. More about the Annals and the other publications of the Computer Society can be found at www.computer.org. To find them, click on the pull-down menu that says Technical Magazines. Other Computer Society podcasts can be found at www.computer.org/podcasts. If you have any comments, we'd always love to hear them. You can send them to podcasts@computer.org. Our theme music came from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. You can find that at music.podshow.com. This has been Computing Lives from the Computer Society. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.